Hello, everyone, and welcome to A Cast of Kings, an unofficial podcast about the HBO original series Game of Thrones. I'm David Chen, and I've never read any of the books in George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
And I'm Joanna Robinson, and I've read every book in George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
And welcome to the show. If you're just tuning in, you can find more of our episodes at GameofThronesPodcast.com. You can also email us at acastofkings@gmail.com and find us on Facebook and Twitter at acastofkings. That's facebook.com/acastofkings or twitter.com/acastofkings. What we do here on this podcast is we will spoil everything through this week's episode of Game of Thrones, but nothing from future week's episodes, which means no future book spoilers. And so that means we're going to be spoiling every single episode of Game of Thrones up through the season finale of season 4, which is entitled The Children. It was a bonus-sized episode. It was like an hour and 5 minutes long this week, just a little bit extra to get in a few of those plotline loose ends taken care of. This is the last recap episode of this season, but it is not the last episode we're recording for this season. We have a bonus episode where we'll go through some of your mail and also chat with a Kickstarter backer. So that's going to be happening sometime in the next week or so. However, a lot of people out there, I know, they're already I'm getting these tweets, I'm getting these Facebook posts, John Robinson. People are already suffering from Game of Thrones and A Cast of Kings withdrawal. So I thought it might be useful to tell people how they can follow our work throughout the year until the next season of Game of Thrones comes around. John Robinson, where can people find you in the meantime until we podcast about Game of Thrones again?
If you want to read the words I write with your eyeballs, you can go to vanityfair.com or you can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. If you want to listen to me with your earballs, you can I have a TV podcast called The Station Agents. You can go to thestationagents.com, and that's a weekly TV recap podcast that I do. I am occasionally a guest on the Splash Film Cast and occasionally a guest on Fighting in the War Room. So you can listen to those podcasts throughout the year, unless Dave and I cook up another project, which is possible. Who knows?
Definitely. And if you'd like to look at my stuff with your eye holes, I would recommend DaveChen.net is where I have a lot of my video projects. I'm also making a film this year. I'll update my website with stuff about that as the year goes on. I also host a podcast called the Slash Filmcast. You can find that at slashfilmcast.com. And find me on Twitter at Dave Chensky. That's Dave Chen, S-K-Y. So that's where you can find us while you're coping with withdrawal for the podcast and the show. I think we'll be coping as well, John Robinson. It's been quite a crazy season. And this is probably, you know, this season of the podcast has been like we've had the most listeners out of any other season. I mean, the show Game of Thrones has recently been announced as the most popular show in HBO history. So it's really, I feel, part of this cultural phenomenon at this point. And so it's been kind of incredible to witness. Are you already missing the show, Jonah Robinson, or are you?
I am prematurely bereft.
Prematurely. Well, the show has already ended the season. So,
oh, I thought you meant the podcast.
Oh.
yeah, I am. You know, George R. R. Martin recently gave an interview to the New York Times where he said that he wished each season were 13 episodes. But I have to admit that as much as I love Game of Thrones, and I do, this is a very intensive 10 weeks for me, and I am kind of looking forward to having a little break. But I wish it weren't such a long break, if that makes any sense.
It does completely make sense, yeah.
If we could have 2 10-episode seasons per year, I could do that. I could swing that.
Right. And for those who don't know, Jonah Robinson does way more work for the podcast than I do. I mean, do you want to give people some insight into the research you put into every episode?
No, because then they're going to give me even more crap when I get something wrong. Like, oh, she works that hard and she still gets stuff wrong? No.
Well, that should be a warning sign that very intelligent people can work very hard and still make mistakes. but yeah, Jonah Robinson, I think you reread the chapter, you watch the episode multiple times, where I basically just show up. Sometimes I don't even watch the episode. So, no, I'm just joking. Anyway, we will miss you guys, and we will miss the show, but stay tuned to all those channels we just mentioned, and you will keep up with what we are up to. So, anything else? We have a couple of announcements. One other announcement, Jonah Robinson, last week you talked about some kind of t-shirt contest. What's going on with that?
I sure did, Dave. We got hundreds of suggestions from you guys, so thank you so much. We have narrowed it down to 5 primo candidates, and we will have a poll up for you guys to vote on. There will be a link on slashfilm.com in this podcast post that you can follow. It'll be up on the Facebook page as well. So we'll be having you guys choose, but thank you. We got so many suggestions, like so many brilliant suggestions. So thank you all for participating. So far, we are moving on to the next stage.
All right. So you find that at facebook.com/acastofkings or at gameofthronespodcast.com. We also like to talk about corrections from the previous week in the course of recording the show. Sometimes we may slip up and make an error. I think the biggest error was my error last week, where I criticized their arrow strategy on the wall, and I was asking, why aren't they firing arrows continuously? It seems like they're being assaulted. Why aren't you, always unleashing the arrows? Why do you have some guy commanding you? And a lot of people wrote in saying that was a dumb criticism, and I accept that. One person wrote in, Joe N. writes in, firing nonstop makes sense if you have an unlimited arrow supply or if you have any enemy charge so bunched and close together that you're guaranteed to hit someone. But what we saw in the last episode didn't indicate either of those. With a limited arrow supply and a charge of troops fairly scattered apart, I think it makes sense to wait until they are as close as possible and in a close enough group that you won't be wasting your arrows firing from a 700-foot wall. Hitting a target from 700-plus feet has got to be pretty tough. From what we saw last episode, I think it's pretty smart to have someone give the command to shoot so that you can be as effective as possible and conserve ammo. End quote. So that's apparently also based on like real-world military tactics with regards to arrows. They don't just let people fire indiscriminately. It's far more effective to fire in a group.
Well, it depends on the right, on the context.
Sure, sure.
And that was, I agreed with you last week, so I'm not like piling on, of course, but like it was brought up in this week as evidence of how Mance Rayder knew how few troops they had, how few supplies they had. He was like, I sent my full force at you. You answered back and it was pretty pitiful. So I know that you don't have much going on over there. So.
Right. Although how powerful is Mance Rayder's full force is my question after what happened this week. Anyway, we'll get to that. We'll get to that. So I guess let's just begin, General Robinson. Let's talk about this episode scene by scene as usual. This episode picks up right after the last episode ended, where Jon Snow is going north of the wall to negotiate with Mance. And there's a lot of ambiguity from my perspective on how this would go. Right? He was going to try and talk some sense into Mance, potentially assassinate Mance.
Right.
Right? And he goes north of the wall with no sort of weapons or direwolf or anything to back him up. A lot of us asked, like, why didn't he take any backup? Some people pointed out that, well, for all Mance knows, Jon Snow is still on their side, right? Because
right.
I think, like, the last they had heard, Jon Snow was still, like, kind of helping Tormund out. That is completely jettisoned immediately because of the fact that, A, Jon Snow is wearing Night's Watch garb, and B, he tells Mance immediately that he is working against Mance's ends. So I'm still not clear on exactly what Jon Snow's plan was.
They wouldn't have let him, the point is they wouldn't have let him into the camp with his sword or his direwolf anyway.
Fair
right?
Enough.
They would have
Fair
disarmed
enough.
Him. They would not have let that wolf in. So I was with you. It felt like a foolish errand, but Mance sort of points out that it's a suicide mission. So if we look at it this way, that this is John's, he's lost his girl. This is his last, attempt to play the hero and it's something of a suicide mission. Then his actions make a bit more sense.
Fair enough. Fair enough. So he has this conversation with Mance, which is the first time we've seen Mance in like 2 years.
Right.
Still awesome, by the way.
Looking good.
Looking good. And they drink to Ygritte and to the dead Night's Watchmen. And it's a nice scene. It's really cool. And then John tries, potentially is thinking about killing Mance, but totally telegraphs the fact that he might kill Mance.
Yeah, he just, eyeballs that Carmen.
He just, looks straight at the dagger.
Yeah.
He's not exactly Jason Bourne.
No.
Let's just put it that way. And then out of nowhere, well, actually, do we want to talk about anything else about this scene? I thought it was pretty good, other than Jon Snow's continued incompetence. I mean, he was very competent last week, but let's face it: if you're going to kill someone, you don't look straight at the dagger before you
And I mean, I think he was feeling a little uncertain as to whether or not he wanted to kill Mance.
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough, but then don't make that uncertain clear, I would say.
Yeah, yeah. I thought it was a little – the conversation was a little out of place. In the books, it's like Tormund is there, and so Jon is talking to Tormund about Ygritte, which seems to make more sense because Tormund and Ygritte are friends. So it was weird to me that Mance is like, so tell me about the girl. Like that was his first – but I do like that they've always had this sort of deeper than – you know, enemies sort of treating type of conversations. So though it did seem a little out of place, I did end up liking it. He did talk a bit about the giants, which I think, you know, we mentioned last week where I said that they were a dying race. And you said that made you very sad. And Mance brought it up in this episode that, you know, it's a big loss for that giant to die. So,
right. And John does get a chance to chat with Tormund as well about Ygritte this episode. So
there is
some closure there as well. So I like this scene a lot. It's great to see Mance Rayder again. Out of nowhere.
Were you surprised?
I mean, yes. Yes,
oh,
I was completely surprised. Not only, not only like that there was, I guess like, why is Stannis even there? How did he even get north of the wall? You know, all these questions filled my mind. That being said, that scene was really well directed. Like the way that the space was conveyed. Yeah. Again, Alex Graves, who directed this episode, makes copious use of these overhead shots, which I thought was great because you really get a sense of like, oh man, they're surrounding them and then they're riding like kind of in a crisscross formation to totally like mow these guys down.
You said again, like, do you mean the same way Neil Marshall did last week?
Alex Graves? I'm sorry. Okay. You're right. Well, Neil Marshall directed last week's episode.
Well, what's interesting to me is, like, I really have this weird suspicion that this was originally in last week's episode, this whole segment. And I don't know if that's could possibly be true. But Neil Marshall did say that he filmed three battles. And I really feel like this was at the end of last week. And this is what a lot of book readers wanted at the end of last week is this surprise arrival of Stannis because it's such a cool moment in the books. And a lot of us, I think that flavored, that soured, and it's not fair. It's not fair that it soured last week's episode for me, but it definitely soured last week's episode for me that Stannis didn't arrive at the end. And if I had my druthers, they would have tacked that 15 minutes extra that they had on this episode, they would have tacked it at the end of last week and we would have ended the wall with Stannis coming.
Why is that so important? Like, you're not the first person to say that. So why is that so important that the Stannis arrival happens at the end of last week?
Just because I feel like that's how you sew up that story. If you're going to condense the entire wall fight storyline from the books into one big episode, the natural conclusion of that is Stannis arrives. Outside of the storytelling of the show, and once again, perhaps this is not fair, I was concerned that people would not be able to keep it a secret that Stannis was coming. That I thought Stannis arriving would be such a cool storytelling surprise for all the people who are watching it and weren't spoiled to come at the end of this episode. And they'd be like, oh, I get this. Okay, it's a wall battle. Okay, we got Mance Rayder. I get it. We've been here this whole time. We're just going to deal with this cast of characters. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, like, we haven't seen him in a couple episodes. And in the book, basically, like, Davos gets this letter, and then you don't hear from Stannis and Davos for chapters and chapters and chapters and chapters. And then they just, bam, show up at the wall. And it's such a cool moment. And I was just worried that it would be spoiled between weeks because book readers were like, oh, the episode didn't end the way I wanted. I really wanted Stannis. And then people are spoiled. Or if they watched the previously on, you know, previously on, you have Stannis and Davos getting the letter from the wall. Like there are all these hints on the previously on that Stannis would arrive. So maybe I was being like super paranoid or whatever. I'm just delighted you were surprised.
I was surprised. I miraculously am able to stay relatively spoiler free throughout the week. So I did not see that coming at all. And Yeah, what you're pointing to, General Robinson, is just a function of the show's runtime, right? That they wanted to convey all this stuff, and they wanted to have this like kind of leisurely conversation between Mance and John, and they wanted to have this huge battle sequence with Stannis, and I think they just felt like that would be too much for last week's episode, both in runtime and plot, probably.
I suppose, and also some people have pointed out that the whole arc would have been a little too much like Blackwater, which also ends with
a surprise appearance by someone who you don't expect, right?
Right. So, and that's kind of a fair point. But if that's, you know, if the books repeat themselves, then, you know, I don't know. We all know I had issues with last week's episode, and I think I would have been less crabby if I had gotten some Stannis at the end. And the other point I want to make about that is that this is really one of, so far in the books, and I would argue so far in the show, this is Stannis's like brightest moment. This is his best moment, his most undeniably heroic victory. And to have it sort of lost in this bigger episode where all these other things happened is disappointing. I would rather have had Stannis have his shining moment in this other episode where we're not going to be more focused on Lannister issues or something like that, if that makes any sense.
It does make sense. And I mean, Stannis doesn't come off, from my perspective, he doesn't come off particularly well in this episode. Like at the end of the scene, I wasn't thinking, man, thank goodness Stannis saved the day, which maybe I would have had more of that reaction if it was in last week's episode.
Right.
And also like, it's not super clear. Like, I guess it's easy for him to just get north of the wall. Like, how does that happen? I guess they just sailed there, right? Is that what we were meant to assume?
Right.
I don't understand the geography very well, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I believe they sail there from Braavos with their newfound riches. That's not the route they take in the books, but...
One thing also that kind of vexed me about the scene is how almost completely defenseless Mance Rayder seems to be. I know that the 100,000 people he has are like warring tribes, and they're not all united in sort of one mass of people, but still, like, how easily Stannis was able to just ride in and just totally destroy these guys made me feel like, wow, all you needed was like, what, 1,000 dudes, was it? So that did strike me as a little bit convenient. I don't know if
possibly reaction- but also there I mean what you had to it's not just defenseless, it's haphazard almost. You see the military precision of Stannis and his forces on their horseback and their formations, their beautiful formations, and that overhead shot you're talking about. And then you see Mance's people just sort of scrapping because that's what they do. And so, and I also think that Mance said his forces were spread out a bit along the wall.
Right.
I don't, you know, they weren't all right there. So, but that's a point taken. Yeah, Stannis never comes off as perfectly great. He always looks like he's sucking on lemons. But, like, I really loved his interaction with Jon Snow.
Yeah, that was
talking
good.
Talking about Ned Stark.
Because as someone pointed out in email, or a few people pointed out in email, this is really one of the only times that Ned Stark's actions have paid off in a good way for his children.
That's a good point, yeah.
Right? And so you think to yourself, hey, maybe goodness does have some benefits in this terrible, terrible world.
And what's interesting about Stannis is he's such a character that's constantly guided by other people. You know, like it's either Davos or Melisandre, and here he's like, well, what would you do? Or what would your father have done? You know, and that's so Stannis to me.
Right. Like if Jon Snow had said, just cut this dude.
Yeah.
Then Stannis might have been like, okay, that sounds good. So they burn the dead. And Melisandre shares this meaningful look with Jon. Mm-hmm. Who knows what that's about?
Through the fire.
And which is very, really beautifully done. And then Jon has this talk with Tormund. Mm-hmm. What did you make of this chat that he had with Tormund, by the way?
I really loved it. But also, it was an important moment that I think we often forget that the Night's Watch are supposed to be sort of independent, an independent body.
They're apolitical.
Right, exactly. And so it's to remind the audience that, you know, even as Mance is saying, we do not kneel. I loved the way he said that, too. He said it sort of good-naturedly. He's like, we do not kneel. Stannis explains the situation more. Mance is like, yeah, I get it, but still, do not kneel. You know, and Jon similarly, like, they don't have a king. They are not, you know, Stannis is not their king. And so I think that's just a good reminder for the audience of that situation. And just, yeah, Tormund's line, you know, the dead can't hear us. I think given that there's a lot of undead stuff in this episode, that's a good reminder too.
Definitely. And so, yeah, it was a really nice interaction, and you kind of, yeah, see that the Night's Watch is like separate, and they don't torture, they don't, you know, they don't have many of the positive or negative qualities associated with a national army, for example.
Right.
So
unless it's – it was unclear to some people that I talked to. So to clarify, the reason Stannis is there is it's these two ideas where he was like, I wanted to become the king to save the kingdom, but now I'm going to save the kingdom to become the king, which I think is just a little clearer in the books about his motivation,
right?
As to why he's there. But there you go.
I appreciate that clarification. But my question is, will people even know that this interaction happened? Like, if people weren't receptive to the idea of Stannis Baratheon as king, are they going to be more inclined now that he has prevented this breach of the wall? Do you know what I mean?
Well, I think he needs to keep amassing forces. And so at least he could gain credit with some of the North, possibly.
Fair enough. That does make a lot of sense. So the conversation with Tormund, I mean, Tormund, I think, made a pass at Ygritte earlier on as well, right?
Yeah. So, I think they tried to imply that he was carrying a torch for her.
Yeah, which I like that moment between Tormund and Jon where he's saying, like, you know, she did love you. And apparently Jon is able to just – people can just go north of the wall dragging corpses behind them apparently it's just cool to do that if you're working in the Night's Watch.
If you helped save the wall,
you get one time, you get one hall pass,
a plus one,
where you can just drag someone north of the wall and burn their body.
Yeah, you know.
So, but it did like provide some nice closure to that plot line. Yeah. I thought. I mean, there's a soft spot in my heart for that plot line. Maybe I just have a thing for women who. Really profess to hate someone, but deep down they really love them. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I don't know why that would be, but in any case, I really liked how that Ygritte storyline played out last week, and I like the fact that he was able to have some closure by bringing her north of the wall and disposing of her body there. So, any thoughts on that, Jonah Robinson?
Well, yeah, and it was very beautifully composed. I don't really know why her collarbone was exposed in that way, but it looked beautiful. So.
She has an amazing collarbone.
It needed to be seen one last time. So.
All right, so moving on. We have some scenes back in King's Landing this week. A lot of scenes, a lot of really consequential scenes, General Robinson. So we start with Gregor Clegane and the Mountain, who is not in good shape. And basically, this new maester, Qyburn, right? Mm-hmm. Is he also the one that saved Jaime?
Yeah.
This new maester is saying, I can bring him back, but he's not going to be the same.
Mm-hmm.
We've all seen how that happens. Like, it just never works out well. For example, for Drogo, that didn't work out well for him.
Mm.
I mean, that's barely bringing him back in that case. They were very graphic in showing his wounds. Apparently, like, it was the implication that that Oberyn had used some kind of poison in his blade.
Yeah. So, like, a lot of people were asking whether or not the Mountain was dead at the end of the duel.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't clear.
He looked dead.
Yeah.
I mean, even in this episode, he looked dead.
Yeah. But basically, Oberyn, had tipped his spears with poison. And they said it over and over again throughout this season that Oberyn was a master of poisons. So he had tipped his spears with poison so that the mountain would die in agonizing pain. And it's a detail. It's a bummer detail that they left out of the show that I really like in the book, where you could hear Gregor screaming throughout King's Landing. And they could have done that really easily, because he seemed like kind of unconscious in this scene, right? But he's just in massive, massive, crippling pain. So, yay, Team Oberyn!
yeah. I guess. I mean, one of the things about this scene is that obviously you have very limited time in the season finale, even with your supersized episode. So the fact that they show this implies to me that the mountain is going to come back and be, you know, consequential in the plot in some way for future seasons. What does kind of blunt the impact, again, is the fact that we have no real associations with who the mountain is, right? Like, is he a fully fleshed out character in the books? Because here, he's just a dude that happens to be strong in the show. And also the Hound's brother, but really, that relationship has not played out, really, I feel, in an impactful way. What are your thoughts on that?
He's a monster in the book. I don't think he's a very deep character in the book. I don't think you're missing out on a lot of characterization. No.
Good to know. It's always great to see Meister Pycelle sort of get his medicine handed to him, which he was in this scene by Cersei. That was very nice. But yeah, it was just kind of it felt to me like a weird scene in the context of the rest of the episode. Like, everything in the rest of the episode kind of moved the plot along in a way that is easy to understand. As opposed to this scene, which kind of seems to be setting up something for future seasons. So
yeah, it does kind of grind everything to a halt.
Yeah, I was just kind of like, what is the purpose of this? Anyway.
I guess they did need to answer the question that people had, whether or not the mountain was dead.
Right.
And there was no other time to do it because, you know, Oberyn died and then we spent an entire episode at the wall. And so they had to cram this scene in here because there was no other place for it, I guess.
Makes sense. So then we get another scene with Tywin and Cersei, which is kind of a mirror of an earlier scene in the season where they kind of talk about Cersei's fate and who she's going to marry and so on. And in this scene, Cersei objects. She says she's not going to leave her child, and uses the one trump card she has to kind of stun Tywin into submission almost.
The old incest card.
The old incest card, exactly right. So the big question for me in this scene, or that I want to ask you in this scene, John Robinson, I guess, is do you think that Tywin really had no idea that this was true? And I think my problem – so I think the scene was really well played. And the way that Tywin plays the scene, Charles Dance plays the scene, is he's playing it as though he really doesn't. No. Like, I saw – my perception was it was genuine lack of knowledge and not denial. But what was your perception?
I mean, I think that's what they were going for, but doesn't that seem so preposterous?
Exactly. That was kind of my point, is that he seemed to genuinely not know the truth.
Yeah.
But Tywin is one of the smartest dudes we know in the show, right? Yeah. Possibly the smartest dude.
Right. Like,
perhaps even smarter than Tyrion. Well, actually, maybe not. Maybe he's only second to Tyrion and Varys, as we found out later in this episode. But anyway, I don't know how I feel about it because it seems to me that Tywin would know. So maybe they were trying to play it as though he was in denial, in which case it did not come across for me. But otherwise, how did you think of, you know, how the scene played out?
It's interesting. Whenever they invent a scene whole cloth that's not in the books, you really want to look closely at what they think adds. What do they think it adds? And I think it's a really interesting expansion on the children theme that we get in this episode. You need to have Cersei in play in this dynamic. One last Cersei-Tywin encounter before he goes. And so for that, I think it was good. I thought Lena Headey was acting her face off. I thought she was really good in that scene. I didn't really love the scene that came after with Jamie. Actually, I really didn't like it at all. But in this one, it was nice to see those two actors together one last time. So,
Well, the thing about the scene, the next scene with Jamie is now we're seeing the limitations of making, basically shooting the entire series before it's been released to the world, right? A lot of TV shows are often still in production while the show is being aired, right? So, for example, if something is horribly misinterpreted, showrunners and directors have a chance to course correct later on in the season. That is not possible with Game of Thrones simply because of how it's produced. They have to make all the episodes often like at the same time. They're shooting a scene from the finale at this, like right after they shoot a scene from the first episode. So they basically have to shoot them all at once and then package them all up. And by the time it's out for the audience to see, it's basically done. Like, they can't go back and fix anything major. So that became a real problem throughout the season, and then particularly this episode in which Cersei goes back to Jaime. And early on in the season, there's this huge question of, was it rape? Was Jaime raping Cersei? And if so, right, what implications would that have for their relationship? They clearly didn't intend for it to be perceived as a rape because it didn't have any implications, really. It was just another kind of step in their really messed up sexual relationship. And I think we see the results of that in this episode, where Cersei takes Jaime back and they do it on the table. They don't care if anyone's watching. Why didn't you like this scene, John Robinson?
Oh, God. I felt like it was, people complained about character assassination of Jaime Lannister in that rape scene earlier in the season, and I would say this is way more out of character for Jaime Lannister, who shoved the White Book, which is this very precious like book of record of the knights, and he just shoved it aside to have sex with his sister on, oh my God, just the place. The place to me seemed more out of character than like against the dead corpse of his son.
I don't agree with that.
No, out of character, because he didn't have a connection to his son, but Jaime is chivalry, like shot through to his bone. That's what he is. He is a knight. That is his thing. I'm not saying that makes him a better person. I'm just saying that that is Jaime's characteristic, is his, attachment to this concept of chivalry and knighthood. I'm not saying for a normal human being, shoving a book aside is less weird than having sex against your dead son's beer. Anyway, I just really didn't like it. I really disliked this scene. I disliked its implications for earlier in the season, and I dislike its implications for going forward. I'm not sure how much more I can talk about it, but it did not go over well with me.
Got it. So one question is, what is Cersei... like, what is Cersei's motivation? Is she genuinely trying to take Jaime back, or is she just doing it to defy her father? Or maybe a little bit of both. Any thoughts on that, or can you not talk about that either?
I can't really talk about it. I do have a theory, but I can't really talk about it. So. Okay.
I guess my perception is... I mean, we haven't seen these characters interact too much this season. She's refused him, and then theoretically she was supposed to be into it in that episode, according to the director of the episode. They kind of had an up and down relationship, right? Throughout the course, like, it was never like, oh, Jamie, I'm so glad you're back. Let's pick up where we left off, kind of thing. And then so I guess this is kind of the thing that catalyzes her feelings for him, is like, oh, you're all I have left because father wants us to do this terrible thing that I don't want to do.
It is complicated by what Jaime does later in the episode.
How do you mean?
That is an interesting and nuanced thing, in that Jaime has two allegiances and he's not choosing.
He can screw his sister and still defy
save
her
his brother. Yeah.
Later.
Yeah.
In the episode,
it doesn't mean he's Team Cersei.
Right.
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 But then if he were fully Team Tyrion, he would never, ever do that with Cersei, right? So he's playing both sides. In that, I mean, he's not playing, but he's refusing to choose.
So really messed up scene, I think we can all agree. And I guess one question I have is like, how does Cersei getting back with Jaime kind of succeed in defying her father, right? Like, what does that accomplish in the Game of Thrones. It didn't really strike me. I guess like it's just this kind of show of solidarity, I guess, saying like, hey, we're united against our father's wishes, and therefore like maybe we can figure out a way to defy him. Of course, all of that is for naught later on, as we learn. But I just trying to wrap my head around like what was her game.
I think it's a little bit her "you have no power over me" move, where, right. But that was accomplished by, in my mind, by her just coming out and saying the incest thing.
Right.
Was her most defiant moment to Tywin. You can't make me do this, and I'm going to keep screwing my brother.
All right. Let's take a quick break, Jonah Robinson, and talk about the Midwest Film Nerds podcast. The Midwest Film Nerds podcast is an hour-long podcast by a group of guys based in Detroit, Michigan. Each of them typically sits down to a movie looking for something different, like technical proficiency, pure entertainment, or emotional resonance, etc. Some movies succeed in pleasing all three, while others leave them divided. And this often sparks an interesting conversation that they hope to encapsulate in the podcast. Yeah, I would strongly recommend this podcast because they were a huge supporter not only of this Kickstarter, Jonah Robinson, but of the Kickstarter project for my film with Stephen Tobolowsky, which you can find at theprimaryinstinct.com. And apparently they have an interview with Stephen. That was one of the rewards, was to talk with Stephen, and they took the audio from that conversation and they're putting it on their podcast. Stephen Tobolowsky, totally fascinating dude. So I would recommend you check out the Midwest Film Nerds podcast. They've been great supporters of us through the years. You can find them at Twitter at mfnpodcast.com. That's MFN, Midwest Film Nerds podcast. And also on Facebook at facebook.com/Midwest Film Nerds podcast, as well as on the website midwestfilmnerds.com. And I believe, yeah, these guys have supported us in previous years, right, Jonah Robinson?
Yeah, they're very loyal supporters, and I've listened to their podcast as well, and I think they're really, really delightful.
They're single-handedly responsible for this podcast existing. No, not quite, but they are a huge help, and so we really appreciate the Midwest Film Nerds podcast. And as for people to thank, I think that is it, right, Jonah Robinson?
Like, yeah, we don't have any names this week.
That is everyone. We have thanked everyone.
No names to butcher. If you didn't hear your name...
or if you didn't hear it in the format in which you prefer,
let us know, because we do have the bonus episode. We will, you know, make up for it. But I believe we hit everyone. So thank you again, everyone.
Yes, really appreciate it.
We look forward to butchering your names in the future.
Right. And if for some reason you didn't hear your name this season, email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. So let's get back to the episode, John Robinson. We had... We finally saw Bran again after what felt like many episodes, right? It felt like
Were you missing him? Were you just like longing
where
for Bran?
Where is Bran?
The real tragedy is we didn't get any Rickon in this episode.
Seriously. So there's a rather spectacular fight scene where Bran, you know, is it warging, right? He wargs into Hodor again. And fights these, as you pointed out on your Twitter feed, Jason and the Argonaut style skeletons. I thought it was a pretty tense and well done action scene. What did you think?
I didn't really love the skeletons. I've heard them compared to Pirates of the Caribbean skeletons. What I found out today, though, is I thought they were all CGI, but I found out today that those were were guys in suits that were then sort of painted over.
Yeah, it looked like guys in suits just because of the way the characters were interacting with them.
Yeah, so, you know, props for that. I rewatched it with a little less of my, like, CG prejudices in place. I still didn't love it. Does it make sense to you who they are, what they are, how they operate, that sort of thing?
That they just come out of the ground out of nowhere after you've crossed a certain point, I guess.
Well, they're the same kind of supernatural creature we've seen before. They're just a lot more rotted. So they're those whites that we've seen before, basically, when dead people come back to life. They're just much older, so they have fewer, less flesh on their bones.
So are they White Walkers technically then?
No, they're whites. WIGHTS. So there's the White Walkers, which are the big icy guys, and then that's why they're burning all the bodies and stuff like that, so right. People won't come back. as whites, W-I-G-H-T-S, like we saw in the pilot episode. So basically these are human, reanimated humans that are enslaved basically to the White Walkers.
I see. Yeah, so I thought this was a well-done scene, and Jojen, I mean, I don't think anyone really expected him to live, but...
Dude's been looking rough for...
He's been looking rough. He foresaw his own death in fire, yeah. I think, right?
Yeah.
A few weeks ago, and so that certainly certainly played out as he predicted, pretty spectacularly with this... what's this girl called? Like, what creature is she?
They're called the Children of the Forest.
Right, and I thought that was actually pretty exceptional acting by that girl, who seemed very sort of otherworldly.
I think they dubbed her over
right.
with someone else's voice, and my favorite part is she delivered one little speech like from behind some brambles. That was the best moment, I thought, because like her mouth was kind of obscured, so it covered any little smidge of a dub issue. I liked it. I loved it. I loved the whole Children of the Forest effect. I thought that was really smart to do it the way they did it. They're a little more eldritch in the books, but I think it would have looked very weird. And I liked that this is just a... It reminded me of, like, I don't know, Legend or something, some 80s movie. You know I like practical effects, so why right. not cast a kid and dub them over?
That was really cool. And then they bring him in to see the Three-Eyed Raven, which I guess is this dude.
Yeah,
And the set design is just spectacular here. I just thought it looked amazing. And how they were able to build this, and not only build something that looked that good, but build it in such a way that they could film in there. I assume they built it. I assume they didn't just happen upon it. I just thought it looked incredible. So,
you don't think that was Carcosa?
Nice. I thought this was better than Carcosa.
That's it was better than Carcosa, yeah.
And then this guy says, "You'll never walk, but you will fly." And if you could see me, you know, right now, you'd see I was making like the jerking off hand motion. Like when, how long are you going to drag this brand storyline out is my question.
Well, I defy anyone to say this is a spoiler for me to talk about, but this is the very end of brand story in the book. Basically they fast forwarded to the end of brand story. And I don't think it's a spoiler because I have no idea where they're going. And it's not guaranteeing anyone's survival because they are off the books and I don't know.
Hold on. You mean even books 4 and 5?
Yeah. This is it. I mean, basically this is it for Bran that we know on the printed page so far.
Wow. So in the known universe, this is all we know of Bran's story.
There's a little bit more, but that's basically it. Yeah.
Wow. Okay, so my concerns are even more validated then.
Well, I think it gives them freedom. You know, if George R. R. Martin hasn't done a very good job of giving us brand material that translates well to the screen.
Of giving us brand new material. You see what I did there?
I do. You know, your opinions may vary on Bran's storyline in the book, whether or not you like it. I never loved it, but some people do, and that's fine. But I think most people will agree that his stuff in the show has not gone over well, and that might just be the fact that chapters that have to do with dreams and skin changing and backstory don't, you know, translate well to a television show. And so now Weiss and Benioff have the freedom to do something a little bit more dynamic with it, which they did. I mean, the like little grenades that the Child of the Forest is lobbing, that's not from the book, you know? So they like did their best to make, and Jojen doesn't even die in the books. He like is maybe dead off screen. So they just sort of tried to like amp up the action for Bran's little story, this finale. And so who's to say, how exciting it could possibly be in the future, or it could be terrible. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, one of the big problems is, like, are Jojen and his sister, like, are they supposed to be – are we supposed to feel something at their deaths? Because we basically know they have very few characteristics, right? We know very little about them. So the fact that Jojen is dying, I don't feel, oh, my gosh, this person we've been on this incredible journey with has died. Like – there's other characters who died in this episode who I definitely felt that about, but not Jojen. And so I feel like it's a failure of this storyline to move us in any way.
Yeah, and it's a failure of like I said, the way in which you're going to adapt those characters, because a lot of their stuff that they do is tell old stories to Bran about, like, the, you know, his family's history, their family's history, that sort of stuff. And you like them so much because of that. And they didn't do it in the show, and I understand why. But yeah, it means that Jojen and Meera in the TV version, and I don't think it has anything to do with the actors because I quite liked them and other things, Jojen and Meera just didn't make an impact.
Yeah.
So.
Well, RIP for a character who made very little impact, unfortunately. All right, only a couple more scenes left to discuss, John Robinson. One of them is the confluence of two major plot lines. Brienne and Podrick encounter the Hound and Arya. And my heart skipped a beat when Podrick recognized who the Hound was.
Mm-hmm.
Because... typically, anytime I was thinking about this, anytime two major storylines collide, people usually die, right? I thought about this, right? Like, we've seen time and time again, whenever these threads come together, like Sansa and Lady Arryn, or Jon Snow and Bran earlier in the season, people die. Things go poorly. So that's kind of why I feel like I had this uneasy feeling this episode when you see these two people, kind of, you feel like something terrible is going to happen. And in fact, that is what comes to pass. Am I wrong in that assessment, John Robinson?
I don't think it's every single time. I was thinking about when Melisandre goes and takes Gendry from Arya. Like, yeah, Gendry going away was bad, but no one died. Thankfully, Gendry made it out of that alive.
Yeah, but that was a close one. He was supposed to die.
P.S. Where are you, Gendry? But... you know, and so I'm sure there are a few exceptions, but you're right that no good can come of it. No good can come of two amazing fighters. I mean, you knew they were going to fight, right?
Yeah.
You got the Hound and Brienne in the same shot. They're going to fight. My big concern carried over from 2 weeks ago is – why did the Hound and Arya just walk away from the bloody gate? I still don't understand.
Right.
They just turned around and walked away. I know I have to let that go, but it's
well,
still
is it, what happens in the books?
They never go to the Eyrie, and they never meet Brienne. So
yeah.
this is all not book stuff, and it was great.
Yeah, it was very good.
I loved the Brienne and the Hound fight, but more than that, I loved Brienne talking to Arya. I could have watched that all day. I loved it.
Well, I loved Arya's, again, completely chilling lack of reaction. I mean, she does a great job. Maisie Williams does a fantastic job acting in this episode. And a lot of that acting is not reacting to what people are saying.
Yeah.
There's just no reaction in terms of like, oh, here's a person who might... like, I think... let me posit that perhaps what the audience wants is for Arya to say, oh, hey, here's a beloved character in the show. Come to free me from this horrifying murderer.
Right.
And you want Arya to be like, yay, and run into this person's arms. But this show subverts that completely. And I love that about the show. It just and why would Arya go running into Brienne's arms? I mean, Brienne is wearing like Lannister stuff, has already demonstrated that she can't protect people, including Arya's mom. So... it makes sense to me that Arya would not be super thrilled about joining forces with Brienne.
But it's also true that Arya is not like the sweet little girl she was. Not that she was ever a sweet little girl, but in the Hound and Brienne, you have these two options. I mean, Brienne is this – it's genius to put the two of them together. And Brienne is this weird specter of what her future could be, you know, as this noble daughter, this fighter. And you see that she's like so into the fact that Brienne is a fighter and stuff like that. And Brienne has honor and is quite noble, despite the fact that she bites the Hound's ear off. But she tries to not kill him, right?
Right.
And this is what Arya could have become, maybe. And she's rejecting it.
Right.
And it's not that she's become the Hound, but she's more the Hound than she is Brienne at this point. And so just setting that dynamic up was really smart, I thought.
And there's this kind of profound moment between the Hound and Brienne where the Hound is saying, like, you know, basically he's saying he can protect her better than Brienne can. And you really get a sense of this kind of parental paternal relationship that the Hound has with Arya at this point. And it's really twisted and messed up. But aren't a lot of paternal relationships twisted and messed up, Jonna Robinson?
Happy Father's Day.
Isn't the Hound all of us, is what I'm saying?
Well, I mean, the interesting thing is he echoes something that we've heard from Ramsay before. Well, Ramsay says to Theon when he's torturing him, if you think this has a happy ending, you haven't been paying attention. And the Hound says, you know, there is no such thing as safety, you dumb bitch, something like that. Like, haven't you learned that by now?
Right.
And what's true is that Ramsay and the Hound, both of which are, you know, killers with a twisted worldview, have it right so far of what we've seen in this world. And that's the other subversion that, you know, similar to what you were talking about that I love so much in the show, is that the Hound is completely right. And even though Brienne is the ostensible hero here, she doesn't have the full picture, and the Hound does. So
it's a spectacular fight scene. They both fight pretty dirty because the Hound is dealing with like an injury, right? And so it's a great fight. It's really tense, and Brienne wins decisively. But you get the feeling that if these guys fought like 100 times. The Hound would win like half the time. I got that feeling. I don't know if you felt that way.
More than half, I'd say. If he were full strength and if he had some like swank armor and Valyrian steel, I don't think Brienne would have had a chance.
Right.
But he was hobbled. What I have seen is some frustrating, seemingly sexist comments. I don't mean to bring up sexism and misogyny every time, but I've seen a lot of people say there's no fucking way Brienne could beat the Hound. And I think, you know, the Hound's not operating at full strength. And so I think it's totally believable in this context that Brienne beat him and barely beat him. And, you know, she's not the same level of fighter that he is, but under this circumstance. I mean, that's why she was able to beat, not that Brienne isn't a great fighter, she is, but she beat Jaime because Jaime had been in captivity. You know, like, she isn't as seasoned a fighter as these famous fighters, but I don't think it's inconceivable for her to beat him here.
So. Yeah. So then Brienne, I felt like she went out not in a great way, like screaming Arya's name, trying to find her. And I just felt like that was undignified. And I felt a lot of sympathy for Brienne. She's trying to do the right thing. She barely knows what the right thing is. Like, what is the right thing? Where is she going to take Arya at this point? You know? And at the end of the day, she killed this dude and is just screaming Arya's name and doesn't know where to get her.
Right.
I thought that was like a rough way for that character to go out for this season.
Also rough time for Pod, man. Pod not doing well. Lost the horses, had one job, which is keep an eye on Arya.
or like help Brienne out during the fight.
No, I loved how he was like, well, I was watching you in case you needed my help. And I'm like, she did need your help, but what were you going to do, Pod?
Exactly. So then Arya has this amazing scene with the Hound.
Fuck it. I'm ready. Go on, girl. Another name off your list. You kept promising me. I cut down your butcher's boy, the ginger. He was begging for mercy. Please, sir, please don't kill me. Please, please. Bled all over my horse. Said I stunk a butcher's boy for weeks. Your sister. Your pretty sister. I should have taken her. That night the Blackwater burned. I should have fucked her bloody. At least I'd have one happy memory.
And again, just like no reaction while the Hound is spilling his guts out, literally. Takes his stuff and walks away. And I think was it the same money bag that the Hound got from that innocent farmer earlier?
I think so.
Perhaps
yeah.
So.
And also, you know, a lot of people have complained about the Arya Hound plot this season, that it seems like they've just been walking around in circles and not really accomplishing anything. But I think what they did they did stretch her storyline out this year, but I think what they did really helped inform this final decision, because you have that scene with the dying man and that act of mercy that the Hound gave to him. And then you have the Hound stealing the money from the farmer and talking about the week. You know, so it's basically Arya absorbing all of these lessons. And so in denying him that mercy – I mean, it carries even more weight because you already learned that lesson, that mercy is a thing that you give, you know.
Even the Hound gives mercy.
Yeah, it's a mark of respect. And she's like, nope, you don't get that from me.
Right. And in fact, like the Hound's attempt to infuriate her.
Yeah, he tries to goad her. And
right.
Nope.
Like probably fail. They certainly fail at inciting the reaction he wanted. And they might have even been responsible for her reaction. So brutal scene and completely chilling, because this is a character who is not only cool with just letting someone die, but is cool with, inflicting the maximum amount of pain possible, and is cold and calculated about making that decision. Right.
Yeah.
There's no emotion at all.
And no semblance of a little girl there.
Right.
Right?
It's just completely gone.
Yeah.
But I think the show completely earns it. So really amazing scene and great performances all around. And, you know, we say goodbye to this character who we've known since the first season. So assuming he dies, assuming some Meister doesn't, you know, swoop around from out of the corner and bring him back or something like that. So finally, we come to it at last, John Robinson.
Do we want to talk about Dany?
Oh, yeah. Crap. Forgot to mention Dany. So Dany's still in her court. They don't deal with anything related to Jorah this episode. That kind of disappointed me. I was wondering if we'd get... I guess the exile of Jorah was the closure that we were going to get. I was disappointed we didn't get any more. But... yeah, this whole season, a lot of people have been wondering, where are Dany's dragons? I guess they're just kind of out roaming the countryside.
Well, we did see that one scene of them, of Drogon, like, barbecuing a sheep or a goat and eating it. So, yeah, they're out, you know, hunting.
Just chilling.
Yeah.
I mean, that has been a question, because if she is the mother of dragons, if she's going to ride to victory on her dragons... you'd think that she'd be able to tame the dragons and use them to maintain control of her people, for instance. But it appears like none of that is happening. They're just out doing their own thing. They killed this kid who was burnt to a crisp. And so her solution is to chain two of her dragons up. I believe she has three dragons total, yes?
Yeah.
So why not chain three dragons up? Is that...
they couldn't find him. There's a throwaway line, but she's like, has anyone seen Drogon... and Grey Worm, I think, said, oh, he was last seen on the cliffs over here. So Drogon is rogue. They can't find him. And he is apparently the one who did this. So.
Right. So, I mean, this episode shows Dany losing control of her plans in two ways, right? Number one, she has to chain her dragons up. Number two, like, the peace that she's created is not long-lasting. And I seem to recall someone on this podcast, John Robinson... bringing up this idea that freeing the slaves would not be such a simple proposition, that not everyone would embrace it because it is a dramatically new way of life, and being shouted down by a lot of listeners. But
did I shout you down?
No, not at all. Not at all. But a lot of people
did.
But
I couldn't back you up either. Spoilers.
But yeah, it turns out that some of the former slaves aren't as excited about this new way of life as she is. And I did like that she kind of recognized – this is kind of like her learning that her idealistic and naive ways are not going to play out as she hopes in the real world, right? That she does recognize that. She says, yeah, you can sign a contract that lasts no longer than a year. And it's kind of her way of saying – conceding that, okay, I'm willing to like backtrack a little bit to keep the peace and make everyone happy. How that's going to play out for her, it remains to be seen. But yeah, she locks up her dragons. I thought the set choice, or if they built it, I don't know how they did this, was amazing. Somehow they got these giant dragon chains. And the symbolism of her chaining up her own creatures was pretty powerful. What did you think of this scene?
Yeah, I thought it was good. I have such a hard time attaching to Danny's story. And I have for a while. But in terms of the symbolism, putting in this episode, the whole connecting theme of children is very, very powerful. And yeah, of course, the whole breaker of chains / chainer of dragons is quite tidy.
Are they going to add chainer of dragons to her increasingly unwieldy list? Yeah, unwieldy list of modifiers or whatever.
Sandy's like, I can't do another one. Yeah. I'm tapped. I'm out.
Do another one.
But I really loved that first slave who came in and talked about his situation. That actor, that delivery, that whole speech, I thought was really, really well done.
I think one of the issues with this scene is that we don't really get a good sense of what the dynamic with the dragons is at this stage, right? In the books, is that conveyed any better? Because I could see it playing out gradually she's losing control. But in the show, we get two scenes this whole season maybe trying to convey that, and that's it, right?
Well, no, I think it's supposed to be a bit of a shock. That you see these dragons as her asset, as her best weapon, and they have been. And then all of a sudden there's a charred body of a child. But once again, it speaks to sort of Danny not thinking any moves forward on the chessboard. And Dora tried to warn her, right? Someone was asking me elsewhere, why were other dragon riders, why were other Targaryens able to control their dragons and Danny can't? And it's because there were, it's like training any sort of animal. There were systems in place, how you feed the dragons, how you treat them. And since there hadn't been any dragons for so long, Dany was just like treating them like a stray puppy that she found on the street and didn't, do what she needed to do.
That never ends well, people. Never ends well. Have you seen, just watch any Planet of the Apes movie or Project Nim. You got to be careful
how you treat your pets. So, yeah, but I don't know. I think they're trying really hard to create this cast of characters around Danny, with Grey Worm and Missandei and Selmy and Daario to a certain extent. But without Jorah there, it's even harder for me to latch on. She's so isolated plot-wise. So we'll see how that keeps panning out.
All right. So now we come to it at last.
Yes.
The fate of Tyrion. Would Tyrion die this episode? And the answer is no. Jaime comes in and rescues him, and the two of them share this nice moment where they're like, I guess this is goodbye. And I was like, oh, that's so sad. Because these two brothers, they really do have a lot of affection for each other and a lot of respect for each other. And so you know that they're probably never going to see each other. I was convinced that Jaime was actually betraying Tyrion in some way. That he was going to go up and find, oh, nope, this you're actually going to your death. We actually wanted to surprise you or something.
Is that the moment in your reaction video where you're like, I knew it?
When I said I knew it, it was because I knew that Tyrion would find some way to live.
Okay.
That was the I knew it. And Joanna is referring to the fact that I posted a reaction video up at facebook.com/acastofkings. And I guess we can talk about that reaction video at the end of this episode a little bit in terms of your disappointment with the episode. Perhaps. Anyway, so Tyrion is apparently able to just wander the halls of King's Landing with no problems whatsoever. Tywin doesn't have guards around or anything like that. He encounters Shay, which is a shocking moment because that was the last naked woman I expected, or not naked, but that was the last scantily clad woman I expected to see lying on that bed. And, we got an email, John Robinson, about people saying how the Shay in the books is different than the Shay in the show.
Mm-hmm.
And how, the Shay in the books apparently was much more craven and opportunistic and wealth-seeking than the one in the show, who actually seemed to have genuine affection for Tyrion, which makes her betrayal in the books make much more sense. Not having read the books, that seemed to make sense to me, because in the show, it comes across as just a complete WTF moment where it's who could have possibly seen that coming? It goes back to the whole surprise versus suspense thing. Is it as effective if you had no idea it was coming? What are your thoughts on how this played out?
I've been a little worried all season about whether or not they were going to pull their punches a bit with this part, because you really see Tyrion go dark here. And they did to a certain extent because, I don't know, it felt rushed to me, and maybe just I was anticipating too much, but the whole thing seemed rushed to me. It's not clear to me why Tyrion goes up from the cells to Tywin's chamber. Like, you know, Jaime's like, go up those stairs, knock on the door, Varys will be on the other side, see ya, and pieces out. And then Tyrion's like, I could, or but, I could go up to my dad's chambers. Like, what's his motivation there is not 100% clear to me, because, you know, this is the last time you'll have to hear me say this for a year, so enjoy it.
Do it.
In the books, they've mentioned a couple times on the show that Tyrion had this wife, Tysha, that he was married to before, whom he loved, and then it turned out she was a whore hired by his father, and he was betrayed. And what Jaime in the books, when he releases him, what he tells him is, no, actually, Tysha loved you. We all lied to you. I owe you. I'm releasing you because I owe you this debt because I lied to you. Tyrion gets enraged, lies to Jaime, and tells him that he killed Joffrey. And the two end like very bitterly and acrimoniously. So they changed that to give you a heartwarming moment between those two brothers. And that's why he then storms up to Tywin's chambers, because he finds out about his first wife. What Dan Weiss, one of the creators, said in an interview is that when they cast Shay, they decided that the actress that they cast was so
good.
In their opinion, quite nuanced. They couldn't make her such a one-dimensional, grasping, opportunistic character. They want to give her a little bit more heart. So basically she takes the place of the Tysha character. So the betrayal is, I loved Shay. I think most people will agree that the grand love affair between Shay and Tyrion did not play out quite so well on the screen. So I don't know. I feel like Tyrion still comes out of this looking really good. Everyone's like, well, yeah, of course he killed Tywin. Tywin's a bastard. Of course he killed Shay. She betrayed him. Like, it all makes sense to me. And, oh, he loves his brother and he's fine. But I feel like
I don't feel that way.
Okay.
But continue what you're saying.
Because I feel like the sense you're supposed to get from the book is Tyrion has fucking snapped. And your two heroes, Arya and Tyrion, have gone super dark. And so it's not just that heroes die on this show or in this book. It's that your heroes live to become scary people.
That you live long enough to see them become the villain. Exactly. Or they've lived long enough to see themselves become the villains.
Exactly. Yeah. And I'm not ready to call them villains yet. But you know, you should be very disturbed by choking Shay.
It is incredibly troubling.
Okay, good. I think some people, because Shay was so disliked on the show, some people were just like, yay, Shay's dead. And that's problematic.
Well, one thing is, I haven't rewatched it, but what my understanding is, on the show, Shay makes the first act of aggression.
That's the other thing. Yeah, she pulls that knife.
Right.
So it's self defense.
Right, and that makes it a lot more problematic.
Right.
In terms of making Tyrion go dark. Exactly. That being said, killing his father, I feel like while he was on the toilet, no less. while he's in the privy, right? That is something that I thought was really, really troubling. The question I have is, like, what was Shay, like, how long did the Shay Tywin relationship last for, right? Is that ever, are we supposed to know that? Like,
I guess, since he, like, took her, the Purple Wedding episode is when she left, right?
Yeah.
And Tywin says, have her brought to my tower, is what he tells Cersei, and then later Bronn says she got on the ship and she's gone. But actually, she's up in Tywin's tower. So she's been there the whole time. So theoretically, they've been boning this whole time. What's even worse, I don't know how clear it comes across in the show, but Tywin has been very anti-prostitute. He's got a huge anti-prostitute thing. That's why he said Tyrion couldn't have a whore.
Yep.
And so the hypocrisy is staggering there.
Right. It's almost like a politician saying he's against something and then secretly doing it in his own personal
life. What? Never happens.
Never happens. So
So, I mean, if it comes across to show watchers, and please do write it and let us know. I'll still really read your emails even after the podcast is over. But let me know if it comes across that way to you, or if you were just cheering Tyrion on. And I'm afraid that, but this might come down to that whole like bad Breaking Bad fan. Like there might be people cheering Tyrion on, no matter what. I don't know. So.
Yeah, I mean, from my perspective, just the act of killing someone while they're sitting with their pants down on a toilet is just, you can't kill someone in a more undignified fashion than that, right?
Right.
So the fact that Tyrion would do that to his father, who is one of the most regal, intelligent, cunning people on the show, it just reduces him down to the lowest of the low. You know, one question in my mind was like, if Tywin had played that scene a little differently, would Tyrion have been so eager to kill him, right? He played it like sort of stern but loving. Like, you are my son. Let's go talk about this. Come on. But put the crossbow down. But he was still very, like, unapologetic.
Well, the breaking point seemed to be him calling Shay a whore.
Exactly.
Over and over again.
Right.
Say that word again.
And what? You'll kill your own father in the privy? No. You're my son. Now, enough of this nonsense.
I am your son, and you sentenced me to die. You knew I didn't poison Joffrey, but you sentenced me all the same. Why?
Enough. We'll go back to my chambers and speak with some dignity.
I can't go back there. She's in there.
What, are you afraid of a dead whore?
Someone said this was one of their favorite lines, so I am going to bring it up. But there's this line in the book where Tyrion, you know, Tyrion's like, "Where? What happened to Tysha? Where did she go? Where can I find her?" Because this is the great love of Tyrion's life, and he wants to know where she is. And Tywin says, "Wherever whores go." It's just the most dismissive, shitty thing to say, and that's what seals his deal. Like, really. So I was missing that line, the wherever whores go line. So instead, it was Tyrion bristling at Shay being called a whore. But when, like, Shay betrayed him quite recently, the pieces don't connect as well as they should, I think.
Fair enough. So, I mean, I still thought the scene was effective. And Tyrion killing Tywin, it just is – it makes me see Tyrion in a whole new light. Because Tyrion knows that killing Tywin is going to have – a lot of reverberating effects for a lot of people. People will probably die as a result. And the people that helped abet Tyrion's escape, like Varys, they're going to be impacted as well, right? And in fact, they are, because like Varys puts him in this crate. And then after
Varys
he hears...
is forever putting people in crates.
After he hears the bells... the implication is that Varys gets on the ship with Tyrion, right?
Right.
And he's like, well, this is going to go badly for me now because I don't understand why it's now even worse for Varys now that Tywin is dead. Like, wouldn't it already have been bad enough that Varys helped Tyrion escape?
I think he theoretically could have snuck in and claimed that he had nothing to do with it.
Right.
Especially since he testified against Tyrion at the trial. Like, I think he has plausible deniability there. But if he tries to sneak in, like, there's no way he's getting back in now that the alarm has been sounded,
right,
and Tywin is dead. So he's about to go back, and then he goes, nope. Just because he doesn't, well, you know, who knows? But he, in theory, doesn't know in the show context what Tyrion did. Like, Tyrion just shows up at the door. He's like, what did you do? Tyrion doesn't say anything. Then he hears the bells. And he's just, nope, guess I'm getting on a boat. All right, so, yeah.
So I guess what I'm saying is Tyrion knows his actions are going to have these, like, long-lasting impact. And he still does it anyway, out of vengeance. And so, at the very least, it's, you know, it lowers my opinion of Tyrion in the sense that he's typically a very calculating, reasoned individual who, in this case, had come to his breaking point. And after suffering one too many indignities, decided to just end his father's life and was just like, I've had it. I'm not doing this anymore. And yeah, this does seem to me like a breaking point for Tyrion as well. So I did definitely get that. And it definitely makes it harder to root for that character. right? So it'll be interesting to see. You know, we've had our many of our main villains die this season, like Joffrey and Tywin, and now our supposed hero, the closest thing we had to one, is now a father killer.
Kinslayer.
Kinslayer, right, or Hand of the Kinslayer.
Kinslayer.
Sorry. Kinslayer, mm-hmm. Fair enough. So, yeah, it definitely complicates the situation. The show ends with Arya getting on a ship and heading to Braavos. To do what? Not 100% clear. Do you have any insight into it? Are you allowed to reveal anything about that?
No, but it's a fun... You don't watch the previouslys on, right?
I didn't, yeah. I heard exactly people saying, please don't, because it will spoil stuff.
Yeah, I thought this week was particularly egregious. But it is a fun payoff for the whole Jack and Hagar plot line.
And can you remind us of that, please?
Basically that he gave that coin to Arya. And he was like, if you're ever in trouble and you meet a man from Braavos, give him this coin, say Vala Morghulis, repeat it after me. She's like, okay, Vala Morghulis. He's like, okay, and then you'll be fine. So when the captain of the ship says he's from Braavos, she's like, I have just the thing, which is this coin and this password.
Right this way, he says afterwards. So
gives her just this like, that guy, that's a random throwaway scene, right? But he just like gives her this look. And then I'm sure you notice, because you always notice more than I do, the beautiful music that closed out this episode.
Yeah, it was a choral arrangement of the main Game of Thrones theme song.
Yeah,
very
loved
beautiful.
It.
Very beautiful. All right, Joanna Robinson. So overall, what did you think of this episode? Because I don't think you were a huge fan.
No, I was a fan of a lot of things. That's not fair.
Because you literally said to me, Joanna Robinson, I had a nightmare last night that it would end this way.
I did, just because of, you know, the promo code that we talked about last week, and a lot of the posts that I've been writing on VanityFair.com have all had to do with a certain thing happening at the end of this episode that didn't happen and may never happen, according to Alex Graves, the director. And I just wish Alex Graves would not give interviews, because every time he does, I get really bummed. I am very disappointed.
Well, there has been a huge divide between book readers and show watchers on this episode. Because for show watchers, it's like, oh, damn, that episode was amazing. And for book readers, it's like, wow, that was terrible. I can't believe how bad that was. And I feel like it has never been more stark than in this episode.
Yeah, stark.
Yeah, you got that. Mm-hmm. It has never been more stark than in this episode, like the contrast between the two groups of watchers. Do you feel that that's accurate, what I just said?
Yeah, I think this is the most extreme divide I've seen. I wrote a post last night on VanityFair.com just about how the book readers, our shock and dismay and disappointment must be what you guys felt, I don't know, watching Oberyn die or something. You know, it's like that sort of George R. R. Martin cruel denying you what you want is what happened to us last night.
I mean, do you think it was purposeful? Like, a lot of people were saying the biggest twist of all was that they didn't include this huge plot development that's supposed to happen.
Well, so huge plot development might be a bit of an overstatement. It's a really cool thing. You asked me, right? You asked me at the beginning of the season what I was most looking forward to.
Yep.
And I said a death, which was Joffrey. A new character, which was Oberyn. And an heretofore unforeseen supernatural event. We did not get the third. I have been looking forward to it. I actually thought it was going to end last season.
Right.
So,
you've been looking forward to it for over a year now.
For a really long time. Now, cooler heads would say that this plot line, and I'm sorry to be so oblique talking about it, but obviously I have to.
I think some people will complain you are not oblique enough, but
I
continue.
Guess so. Yeah. Sorry.
I think you were being the correct amount of oblique.
Okay. That they might include in the future, so who knows, but it's not really that important. Thematically, it would have worked perfectly in this episode. It would have been really cool to watch your reaction video when it happened. But how much of our disappointment around it is not getting to watch our show watcher friends freak out over it the way that we did? I don't know. Yeah, but they might never, you know, they cut. Now that we're at the end of Bran's storyline, we know for certain that they've cut another character completely. And so they may very well just leave this out. And that's fine. But I'm disappointed. Yeah.
Well, General Robinson, the words of Billy Joel come to mind. I'd rather laugh with the sinners than cry with the saints. And by that, what I mean is I'd rather enjoy this show with the non-book readers than be pissed off at it with the book readers.
Totally.
It's not as elegant when I paraphrase it, but still.
No, I mean, I envy the show watchers. And I wish – no, I wish
– I wish I had your ignorance.
No, I wish that I had watched that episode and been like, oh, snap, Tywin's dead. Like, that would have been hugely great for me. And the Hounds – I mean, it's not like a bunch of shit didn't happen in this episode. But, you know, just like I – and I really don't want to fall into the trap of I was expecting one thing and I didn't get that one thing, so nothing else lands with me. And I think that's what some people thought – my disappointment over last week was just because Stannis didn't show up. That's why I had a problem with that episode. That's not the case. And once again, this week, you know, if you're misinterpreting me, I urge you to go back and re-listen to this episode and all the things that I really did like. But yeah, it's a big deal. It's a big deal that this thing isn't in there, and it may never be. So,
all right. Well, I, for one, had no idea what the hell you're talking about, so I enjoyed the episode just fine. But Jonah Robinson, I guess overall. So overall, I mean, I'll say that I enjoyed the finale. I mean, people have made jokes about how I'll start off saying, "Hey, I like this episode," and then spend the next hour saying all the things I don't like about the episode, and then conclude by saying I like the episode. But in fact, it's the way it goes. Overall, I like the episode. I had a lot of issues with it, but there's more good than bad, and specifically the Arya Hound stuff. The Tyrion stuff, despite some of the character inconsistencies, like with the Tyrion stuff, like it still is amazing television, and so I thought it was a solid finale. If anything, the only disappointment is that there was this thing that you were talking about didn't happen. So I'm like, what am I missing? You know. Now
I look forward. Well, I look forward to the day when it's conclusive that they're not going to use it. And then I'll be able to talk to you about it.
I see. I look forward to that day as well, if it ever comes, Jonah Robinson.
Yeah.
So overall, season 4. I mean, we're going to talk more about our overall thoughts next week. But I guess overall, season 4, was it a good season? How does it rank in your Game of Thrones seasons?
Well, here's what I'll say is I think this section of this book is the best that Game of Thrones, that A Song of Ice and Fire gets. Not just because the body count is so high, which it is, but it's because the stakes are so high because we spent all this time with these characters, so we built up. So, you know, Ned dies at the end of the first book, and that's a big deal. But now we've got all these complicated relationships that we spent time with, and so the stakes are just that much higher and more complicated and nuanced. So I'm delighted we got to see this on screen. I think they nailed one of the most important things, which is the Oberyn arc. I think that was just something that they just hit out of the park. And a lot of stuff that they did add really, really helped, I think, add some nuance to it. I regret some things that they skipped, but that's always going to happen with adaptation, I think. So ranking. This might be my second favorite season.
And maybe? Your first favorite being?
Season 3.
Yeah, season 3 is still my favorite. And I would say it's a competition between season 4 and 1 for second favorite.
Yeah.
And then season 2, a distant fourth.
Yeah.
Anyway, we will talk more about this next week, and we are eager to hear your feedback at acastofkings@gmail.com. We'll read some of those emails, talk them over. Your thoughts on the season, your thoughts on the finale, feel free to share them with us again at acastofkings@gmail.com. And check out facebook.com/acastofkings to see my reaction video and to vote on the slogan for a Cast of Kings t-shirt. So we've already gone over where people can find us, Jonah Robinson. Just quickly on Twitter, you can find Jonah Robinson at Joe Wrote This and me at Dave Chensky. And I think that's going to wrap us up for this week. Thanks so much for listening to A Cast of Kings. We'll see you guys later.